Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. I have with me today Kathy Melcher. She's from Portland, Oregon. And I met Kathy ages ago, and she's been in the Portland, Oregon community, Reiki community, for many, many years, and somehow we've been sort of in the same community but not really connected until just a few months ago, actually. And I've discovered that she is a wealth of knowledge and of interest, and I'm really happy, Kathy, to have you on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, great. And Kathy is the wife of Frank Kopeters, and you're going to hear these two interviews back-to-back, which is really exciting. And I really met Kathy in November of the last year when we were all at Canyon Ranch together, and I discovered that she had a beautiful voice, very clear articulation of her feelings, and just a very sweet soul. So, Kathy, thank you for, I don't know, this timing was great.
Well, I guess we all cooperate in it together, huh?
Yeah, we do. We do. It's wonderful. So, Kathy, I love starting out with people talking about their Reiki story. And if you could share yours, that would be wonderful.
I'm happy to do that. I started out in the Reiki community before I actually had personal Reiki. Phil Morgan and his wife Marty came to live in our condominium complex shortly after Frank became a master with Phil. And so I had daily exposure to Reiki and the Enlightenment game from about 1989 on. And that was quite an experience, you know. It was just this tight little family, and that's what we did most of the time, was Reiki and the Enlightenment game. But it was in 1993 that Frank initiated me into Reiki 1, and he thought that since I had a drinking problem, that Reiki might be able to help me heal from that. Uh-huh. And so we took our first honeymoon. We were married in 85, and in 93, we took a honeymoon to Hawaii. And I had stopped drinking on the 17th of December, you know, and popping aspirin, hoping that I would survive. And he initiated me in Reiki 1. And conjunctive with that experience was an appointment with Papa Awe, who was a well-known Hawaiian healer who did a lot of work with the Mayo Clinic. And his whole idea was how to learn from your disease, which for someone with an alcohol problem is probably foundational. And he was a lovely, sweet man who told me, you know, in the beginning, he gave me some herbs to help with my nervous system. And then he said that I should eat poi. And, of course, you and I have talked about poi. I'm not that fond of it. And that is one of the prescriptions that I didn't follow. But I followed everything else that he told me.
Well, I totally empathize with you about the poi, for sure.
Yeah. And it turned out that he was the great kahuna of Hawaii. And I didn't find that out for many, many years. I knew about his work with the Mayo Clinic, but I didn't know his standing as a healer. And he was apparently incredibly well-known and well-respected by the whole Hawaiian and the world community. So I was very lucky to meet him. And at the same time, have my system really harmonized by being initiated in Reiki 1. Uh-huh. And that experience was like coming home. And that was the beginning of a whole transformative process that I think Reiki has worked in my life. The following year, Frank, we went to Egypt And Frank thought it would be good for me to be initiated in Reiki 2 at the Temple of Luxor. And so we got to Egypt at a very dangerous time, and our only reason for going there was to go to the Temple of Luxor and to explore Egypt from a kind of experiential basis, and also to do the Reiki initiation at 6 a.m. at the Temple of Luxor. And that was an incredibly beautiful and refined experience. I remember the sun creeping over the wall, you know, that beautiful sunrise coming, and it, you know, the light entering, and it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. So, that was, the beginning of Reiki for me, and plenty for me to handle, because there was a lot of work that we needed to do in the family. We had lots of friends with whom we did Reiki, of course, but the family needed a lot of work, particularly Frank's mother, who had some severe back problems. And so Frank and I began giving her Reiki early on, and she actually became a student of his. And then later, Frank's brother and our sister-in-law, Tina, or Kiki, also began giving Frank's mom Reiki. And so she had 4 people giving her Reiki at a time. And I'm sure that was an incredible experience for her.
Yes, Frank, especially because it was, you know, her children and their, you know, their spouses, and yeah. What a beautiful experience.
Yeah, and she was always extremely grateful. Frank's dad, on the other hand, was a little bit skeptical about all that healing, although Frank had quite an experience with him one time, and I'll let him tell that story another time. But later, Kiki gave him a book on Reiki, and she said that one day she came in the room and she found him doing the hand positions and doing Reiki on himself. So he was doing self-Reiki, self-taught by a Reiki book, but would never receive the initiation from his son, you know? And it was just a beautiful story, and I think so typical of Frank's dad. He was such an independent guy.
Wow, that's interesting. Very interesting. Great.
Yeah.
So first and second degree were really focused about you and your own personal process through this alcoholism and whatever process that had to take, it sounds like.
Yeah. And it was a whole healing for my family because my sister, I have one sibling, I have a sister, and then both of my parents, all of us were alcoholic. We drank alcoholically. And the parents never made it to sobriety, but my sister and I both did. And my sister is still very interested in and grateful to Reiki for what it brought into our lives. But, yeah, it was a family disease.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole work with Reiki was really to, especially with Reiki 2, was to heal that family scene. And so that is what did take place over a number of years. And what was really beautiful is that in my mom's last days of her life, and she died of uterine cancer, in the last days of her life, she always asked to have her hand held. And that was the way through which she received Reiki from both Frank and I.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, it made a real difference in her passing and in our relationship together.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Very beautiful.
So, finally, graduating from some of the family issues, in 2003, I decided that I would go for mastership. And Frank had said, well, you can't do it with me. You know, that's a little bit incestuous. You're going to have to do you're going to have to do it with someone else. And so there was Paul Mitchell right there. in front of me, and I asked him if he would consider being my Reiki master. And he said yes. So I wrote my letter of intent in 2003, and I told the story about my recovery from alcoholism, or my ongoing recovery, in that letter. But there was a significant event that really led me to make the decision on that particular day. And it happened that Frank and I were in Mount Shasta, California, and we'd done a workshop, and we had some free time at the end of it. And it was early in the morning, and it was a house that had a lot of glass windows overlooking Lake Shastina. And all of a sudden, a bird flew into the window and was knocked unconscious on the porch. And this happened a lot, and it freaked me out. So I ran out, and I called Frank. I said, "Come, Frank, you know, come on, let's do Reiki. This bird is, he's not well. We have to see if we can bring him back." And so we did Reiki on the bird, and it took quite a while. It took about 15 minutes, and finally the bird came back to consciousness and pooped and flew away. But later that afternoon, we were giving each other Reiki outside, and Frank was giving me Reiki, and he said, "Babe," he said, "look up." And there in the trees were 30 brothers of that bird looking down on us.
Wow.
Reiki to each other. And I thought, wow, you know, if the birds can recognize Reiki, you know, this is a really transformative practice. And so we took a walk. We went to Dunsmuir Falls and talked a lot about the whole process of becoming a Reiki master. And that's when I wrote my letter to Paul.
Beautiful.
Yeah, but it took me a while. It took about 4 years for me to finally become a Reiki master. And it's difficult to explain that internal process, but for me, it was mostly waiting to feel the right moment, waiting for some kind of sign or a signal that I was supposed to do something about this. And, you know, nobody gives you a manual for how to become a Reiki master. I wish there were one. You hear stories and you hear anecdotes, but for every person, it's an individual process. So it took me a while. And finally, one day, Paul said, "Well, how would you like to be initiated in December? And I'm having some people come to the Dojon, and maybe you would like to do it then." And I said, "Sure." And so we drove down to do some Reiki classes in Salem, and I assisted him and observed. And then that December, I flew to Spokane, and of course, it was in the middle of a blizzard. And I arrive at Spokane, and there's Jerry Jackson and Neerdosh and a Russian woman named Galina. And apparently I'm going to be the one that's going to drive us over the mountain to Paul's Dojon from Spokane. And I look out the window, and there's like a foot of snow out there. And I run to the counter, and I get the last SUV to drive over the mountain. And we get in the car, and we start over. And there is nobody going over the mountain, absolutely no one. There's semis to the side of the road, pickups to the side of the road. There are cars. There are people, you know, standing out, looking around, trying to put chains on their vehicles. And we're still going over the mountain. And it was really a white knuckle experience. But we finally made it to the destination and took it in stride. And we were there at the Dojon for about, I don't know, 5 days. And the Russians were having, you know, trouble with jet lag, and they were up at 3 a.m. and hungry. And Jerry and I were trying to sleep and trying to figure out what it was we were learning in these classes, you know. And finally, on the last day, she looks at me and she says, "Well, don't you think this is a day to be initiated?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, let's get dressed." So we get dressed, and Paul and Susan show up in jeans, and Paul sees that we're all dressed up. And he says, He says, maybe I better go change my clothes. It looks like an initiation's going to take place. And we were like, well, yeah, you know, come on. It's the last day. So we didn't realize what day it was, but all during that training, both Jerry and I had had a particular attachment to Chihiro Hayashi and to his story and just to his vibration. And there we were being initiated on Pearl Harbor Day, the day that Hayashi did not want to participate in or chose not to participate in. And it was just a very, very special day to be initiated.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
It was magical. It was really magical. So, following that experience, I began directly giving Reiki to colleagues and to clients. And I'm a mental health therapist. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. And the board has never given direct permission to do Reiki on clients, but we did inquire. And we never received a no. The main question was Reiki done on clients who were clothed? And it was not considered massage. And we were like, yeah, so it wouldn't be necessarily the jurisdiction of the massage board. And we never received a no back. So a colleague and I decided that we would move forward with our experiments in giving clients Reiki. And what was interesting about that is that never gave clients Reiki who didn't ask for it, but found that people were very intrigued by the whole idea of a way of accessing peace without having to talk about it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's one of the problems with talk therapy is that we have all these modalities. There's now this whole kind of movement into mindfulness and the whole concept of meditation and how that really helps one step back from symptoms and to get a larger sense of who we are in this process of life. And what the meaning of that is, and there's no end to the dimension of that that can be explored. But as it's been coming into talk therapy, you know, like cognitive behavioral therapy or dialectical behavioral therapy, there have been some issues about that, just about how, what place it has and exactly how you use it. And so it's been an experiment. I consider Reiki a form of mindfulness, if you want to say. And I mean, that's how I place it in my practice. And I use it with very severe patients for whom no other kind of modality seems to work. So we're talking about people with diagnoses like schizoaffective disorder or severe personality disorder and depression or extreme anxiety, those kinds of diagnoses. And what I found is that it does seem to bring an element of peace to people's lives. And it's something that you can feel on a vibrational level. Whether or not they're able to articulate it, that varies with the experience. But,
right.
But I have had some, really great experiences with clients in this process.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe exactly what the process is like? do you give them a Reiki treatment after they ask for it?
Yeah, so.
What's your kind of,
I usually am doing the head positions and the heart position.
Uh-huh.
And the reason being that I think the mental position really has some elements of release and insight in it that I think when you get people going in that direction, that it helps to release whatever is hidden in the psyche and bring forth some kind of either conscious realization or just some kind of relaxation and refinement to the energy that enables people to feel more at home with themselves. And, you know, that conversation you and I had talked earlier about how Reiki is a kind of a refinement of our spiritual, physiological energy. And you know, my first experience of Reiki was quite ecstatic. I never thought that I could experience by someone putting their hands on me, just kind of crossing into another dimension of feeling so much peace and so much, lightness of being. And I think that if any human being can have that experience, that it's well worth the experiment to go there. Now, whether or not people can actually take it in and move with it, that's another matter. And I think that's another part of the practice with mental health patients, where you're trying to get people to actually attend to what's just happened to them or is happening in the moment.
Right.
So it's like an extension. It's a really deep penetration of the now experience. And that most people avoid living in the now if they have symptoms like depression and anxiety, because the now is fraught with all kinds of reminders that life is miserable, and so they don't really want to go into the now.
Right.
But somehow Reiki enables a person to feel safe and secure so that they can go deeply into the now and to experience that lightness of being, and that, I guess, that thing that we call healing, you know, but it's such a broad word, such a broad word.
Wow. Well, that's beautifully said. I love that. I love that image of the lightness of now, and that Reiki allows us to be able to be present in the now. And then be able to make, and then I would add, or maybe I'm adding, and so I'm just checking with you, and maybe making choices about our life then, and about how we respond to what's happening in the now.
Yeah, like there is some kind of deep acceptance that comes, maybe not, you know, some people have really penetrating experiences the first time they have Reiki, but for others, it's a cumulative experience. And so at some point, there is this deepening acceptance of being in the now and being in Reiki, you know, in the now
right.
of Reiki.
Right.
And that's kind of the threshold that I'm looking for when I'm working with people, in this experiment, you know, to try to see if they actually can come to a place of acceptance, for who they are, for where they are, for their place and their energetic contribution to life, that goes beyond having symptoms and feeling miserable, but goes into that dimension of, you know, that's more meaningful for us, that has, it's this thoughtless wonder that we experience in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thoughtless wonder. Can you say more about that?
Well, I, you know, the other thing I think that a lot of people suffer from in my practice is an overabundance of thinking.
I think that is, I think.
A torturous overabundance.
I'm laughing because I think that's pretty much worldwide.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that it's increased over time. I think there was a time when we were more naturally bound to the earth and to the stars. and that we're more indoors now than out, and we're more in our heads. We have computers, cell phones, you know. I mean, that whole iteration of technology that just kind of makes thinking more predominant rather than less. And so to experience, for people to first experience no thought, to be just in the now, to be just in that, well, you know, beyond emotion, more in the refined energy of the body, mind, and beyond, that between space between the body and the rest of the universe, that people come to experience that. And that is, you know, a thoughtless wonder, is just being in that space, being held in that space, being suspended in that space, and really feeling nurtured and loved and experiencing their own caring, you know, their own deep caring for this. So yeah, I'm not saying that all thought has to stop, because I think, you know, functional thought is also good for people who are trying to get over, to overcome their depression and anxiety. If they have a thought that says, I need to take this action, or I need to do this to improve my condition, that they then act on that. But, I'm just saying in general, when you're in the now, you're not really thinking.
Right.
It, you know, a thought may come through, but it's not that you're actively, obsessively thinking about something.
Well, this sort of leads me to explore this a little bit more, because there's an interesting question that comes up very often around Reiki treatments. And this question is about somehow the now and what you're speaking about. And that is, let's see if I can frame it appropriately. People ask, do I need to be in a special place in order to receive Reiki? Do I need to be, well, a lot of people use the word pure, but that's, you know, that's, I think, not really what they mean, or maybe it is what they mean, in the sense of purity of thought and so on. And what I tend to go to when people ask me this question is, well, trust where you're going, because actually it's not about being worthy of the energy. It's about just simply being the energy.
Yeah.
Am I making myself clear?
Yeah, that's really clear. And the other thing is that the Reiki is, yeah, the Reiki's doing the work. You just have to surrender to the Reiki, and the Reiki will do the purifying and the refining.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that piece of information, when we were talking the last time about, the physiologist that's doing all these measurements of the refinement of Reiki with brainwaves, I mean, that I think is evidence that the Reiki is doing the work, or we are cooperating and co-creating with Reiki to make this happen, but it's not something that we're engineering out of our egos, or it's just something that's happening.
Right. And how could it be so simple? And how could it be that we're not in charge?
I don't know, but I really think that it's true that that we're not in charge in the way that we think that we're in charge.
Right.
That there are decisions that we make, little subtle decisions about allowing and accepting and helping.
Uh-huh.
Helping's maybe, I don't know, a little too active. I don't know. But that's kind of the subtlety of it. And if we start entertaining the idea of being worthy of the energy, then that takes us down that whole egoic path of the story of how I'm not worthy to receive this wonderful energy. And therefore, it becomes an obstacle to receiving it.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm really interested in what the potential of this means for us, you know, for the community and for the world at large. Because the experience that I had sitting at the Reiki home, sitting at Kenyon Ranch, was that there was nothing that needed to be done. And that already everything was perfect and peaceful and calm. And that seemed to be the experience of all the group participants that were there. So it was a complete surprise to all of us that we arrived there. We sit in our first circle and there's that experience. We have already entered into the field. It's there, it's happening, and nobody's done anything. They just came.
Yeah, we just got there.
Yeah, we just got there, and there it was.
Yeah. And so perhaps our participation is simply listening to where we are led to be in a given moment.
Yeah. And maybe where we're destined to be, where, you know, that ultimately this is the way we really are and not the other ways that we've understood ourselves to be or misunderstood ourselves to be.
Uh-huh. Gosh, it's really it's like, sometimes I feel like, I studied psychology also, and I think I just wanted to have a feeling of what I was supposed to be as a human being. You know, that was my, that was my big question. It never got answered, of course, but because, at one point when I was studying, it was, you know, in the way back and beyond in the 1960s, actually. And, you know, I was supposed to be, an organism that could be trained to do whatever anybody wanted me to do, which I, you know, was really rebellious about. And then, and then I became a human being, which was nice. And then I became a human being with a soul. And then I became a human being that was connected to everything. And I think that's where we've ended up in this kind of, advancement of seeing the whole of human beings, but then we look out at the world and say, gosh, you know, if we're all one, I don't want to be that one over there.
That doesn't look like much fun over there.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Or, gosh, that looks really stupid. And, so it's now our job to, be able to be all those ones. And be able to choose the one that we are in the present.
Gosh, yeah, that sounds really, on that very great. On that very subtle level.
Yeah.
But the, you know, you're talking about a time in the 60s that was really at the very vibrational change point of the human potential movement.
Yes.
You know, where it moved out of that prescripted world of mental and started moving into the body. And the minute that therapy started to move into the body, that's when some real transformative experiences began to happen in therapy itself. And it's true that you can get hung up in the body because, you know, eventually we all have to go beyond the body, 'cause that's our journey in life. But it was a very exciting time and a very active time. You know, and if you look at therapy on a continuum, or you look at human potential, I like that better, that word.
Right.
On a continuum, it's like we are limitless. We really are limitless, and we're all inclusive. You know, we can be that one over there, but we can also be the best, the most refined, the most exquisite energy on, you know, going.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what I found the promise of the human potential movement. You know, that's always been so very exciting to me that actually that there are things that we can do with ourselves to place us in a position where we can have these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And come to believe more fully in ourselves.
Right, right.
You know, and I think that was the whole reason that Esalen was established, you know, was to sort of be the forefront of that kind of an exploration for people. And they have done over the decades some very exciting kinds of things. I mean, you know, Fritz Perls was there, and that was the whole generativity of Gestalt and all the wonderful things that came after Gestalt. But they actually have an ongoing longitudinal program there where people have been participating for 20 years. And it's called the Integrated Transformative Practice. And it requires people to have a spiritual practice and a physical practice and a mental practice and a profession that brings them joy. And so they work in all these modalities, and then they get together on a periodic basis and report back about the success of their lives and how happy they have become.
Fascinating.
And in this study, so it was begun by the two founders of Esalen, George Leonard and Michael Murphy. And thus far, people are becoming happier. And there are all these, studies that are, and communities of studies that are springing up all over academia and in more informal settings, where people are actually studying happiness, flourishing, flowing, all these kinds of things that people have been wishing that they could have. And then they're studying the minute ways in which people can make them happy, make themselves happy, like balancing a checkbook, you know, getting their errands done, or working in the garden, you know.
Uh-huh.
That it's these simple things that lead to cumulative happiness.
Uh-huh. Gosh, that's a concept, cumulative happiness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Starting with the small things and leading to, you know, never giving up until you finally get what you want, the ultimate, you know,
yes.
what you want.
So somebody asked me the other day, which I actually didn't have a great answer for, how do you know when you're happy?
Huh? Well, I think that would be, you know, kind of a self-feedback kind of loop there. How do you know when you're happy? I think people recognize happiness when they feel it, unless they've been desensitized to it by being miserable so long. You know, maybe happiness is like the piccolo playing in the orchestra. It's not necessarily ecstatic. It's more of a contentment. It's more of an openness to what is, and not necessarily pleasure. Although pleasure might be involved in cumulative happiness, but happiness is a state of being, or is our essential being. If you believe the Buddhists, you know, they say that happiness is our original face. So, yeah.
That really is very helpful, because I think that most of us, maybe it was the happy face that did this. I don't know. But most of us, and I know, when you say what you just said, it reminds me that I equate happiness with a smile, with laughter, with not being carefree, I would say. And that's not necessarily being a state of being. Does that make sense?
No, it might be momentary. That particular aspect of happiness might be momentary. But the place where you reside, where I reside, where, that is not moved, that is always in the background, that is always giving to me, that is my refuge, that is my contentment, my lightness of being, my home, that, you know, that's always there. I may not always be able to access it because there are obstacles in the way. My thoughts, my feelings, my stories about myself, my, you know, my physical sensations or whatever. But ultimately, I can retrieve my place there if I just allow the things that are in the way to dissolve. And that's what Reiki helps these things to dissolve. Reiki helps obstacles to dissolve. That, you know, that I think is the miracle of Reiki.
Right. And the other miracle of Reiki is that, you know, as I hear you speak, the other miracle of Reiki is that it brings you to that place, even if it's momentary, to remind you that this is indeed within and that it's achievable.
Simply.
And without much effort, actually.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Yeah, and that effortlessness, you know, like when we were back at Kenyon Ranch doing this group and doing the Reiki in the afternoons.
Yes.
That was so sweet and so effortless, and it contributed to the bond that we had with the Kazakhstanis, even though we couldn't speak the same language, that we had this peaceful bond between us, and we could sit quietly, we could eat our meals together. We were one, you know, we were one in Reiki, we were one hanging out, but I don't speak Russian and I don't speak Kazakhstani, and yet I felt completely relaxed and at home and in harmony.
Right.
So, yeah. I just think the potential for this in communities, in individuals, in communities, in families, in the world is tremendous. You know, the potential here is tremendous. Imagine if 2,000 people in a room were giving each other Reiki. You know that story about transcendental meditation, that the practitioners of transcendental meditation would come together once a year for their convention in Washington, D.C., and every time they did it, the crime rate would go down by 25%.
Really?
So these guys came together and meditated and levitated and whatever else it is that they did in their practices, and the crime rate in Washington, D.C., for those 5 days that they were meeting together went down 25%.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are these subtle evidences that show that when you have a subtle practice that's moving toward the positive, the more people participating, the better it has an effect, the vibrational effect on the atmosphere around it.
Mm-hmm. Which brings me to an interesting and well-explored question that was brought out by us conceiving this, I don't like to use the word project, but this calling Reiki Home. And the question was, what is really our service to humanity? And it's easy to go back to the physicalness of it and say, well, you know, it's Reiki treatments, it's teaching Reiki and so on. But that for me is building the vehicle to create the service. And this process that you talked about the transcendental meditators going and practicing, you know, thousands of people going and practicing the same practice, affecting you know, everyone around them, because we are all one, is definitely in the same direction.
Right. And it's a subtle, multidimensional, it may be measurable. I mean, if you look at the experiments of Elmer Green in the 60s and 70s for trying to measure subtle energy, he was able to do it on a certain level working in biofeedback, but he never got to the point where he could ultimately measure it.
Right.
I mean, yeah. But, that doesn't matter, you know, if the effect is felt, if the effect of a peaceful community is felt by the world around it, the responses of the world around it to its being there will demonstrate that.
Right. Right. And, you know, this very important lesson that our Reiki practice gives us, which is that if you've experienced it, then it's your reality.
And
yes. Well, yeah. Anyway, it is for me. That's how I interpret
yeah.
it. And that, it's only, I am the only one that can give away my own experience. So if I give that away, that's my problem, so to speak. But if I keep it and nurture that experience, then it just builds and becomes, as you said earlier, cumulative happiness.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is that people who have a long time in Reiki mastership, who sit with the energy, who have had all different kinds of experiences, but are staying in the energy over long periods of time, those are different people than those who first crossed the threshold of becoming Reiki masters, you know? There's, it's a matter of commitment, I guess, that one sits with that energy and allows it to develop and allows it to expand within, that enables us to move into dimensions that we would have never thought possible in this healing practice, and to come to an acceptance of a lot of unusual things that come the way without freaking out.
Right.
You know, but just going, oh, wow, that too. Oh, okay.
Right, exactly. So I had this insight not very long ago, actually, about the story of Mikao Usui, and thinking, somebody asked me about miracles and why weren't there miracles in the story of Reiki? And I went, what? And it was like, okay, let me just think about this for a few minutes. And I realized that the kind of miracles that he had were like daily miracles. Like he stubbed his toe, put his hand on his foot, and the pain and the bleeding stopped. And somebody could say, yes, but that's no big deal. But there, yeah. But it's like, this whole concept that miracles have to be a big deal in the sense of,
a scale
of relativity.
Yeah.
So if in our present time there is no scale of relativity and miracles are simply miracles, then, you know, stubbing one's toe, putting your hand on it, and having the pain go away is as big as, you know, getting to a car accident, applying Reiki, and feeling like you've just saved somebody's life. I mean,
sure,
miracles are just miracles, right? So it is that particular manifestation of our reality, you know, what we experience as reality, is very, very interesting for me. And I feel like Reiki gives us a doorway in which to really learn about daily miracles and about cumulative happiness and about being human.
Wow, it brings up a lot when I think about, I'm a student of the miraculous. love all kinds of stories about miracles. Wonderful. And I do think there's a tendency in our culture to go for the dopamine effect. So a miracle might be on the order of, you know, the wow, zap, zowie of a video game, you know, that we tend to look at miracles in the expletive instead of in the simple. And Reiki is, it's in the simple. It's in the natural. It's in the vibrational. To look for a superlative, I mean, there are superlatives. There are people who've had remission, but not everybody who receives Reiki has a remission, right?
Right.
It's fun to explore, to see, okay, if the bleeding stopped and believe me, I think bleeding stopping, that's a miracle.
For sure.
If the bleeding stopped, if the person feels better, if the first aid has been applied and it enables the person to get up and move on, that is a restoration of functionality. That's a miracle. You know?
Yes. I love your phraseology, restoration of functionality.
Yeah, person gets wow. up, goes back, you know.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow.
Anyway, you know, it's sort of like then the question is what next? And I suppose yes. that we
good question, Kathy. What's next?
We just wait and see. I mean, we don't know, but we don't know.
Uh-huh.
People say, nobody ever told me that when I reached the age of 66 that I would have as much joy in my life as I do have. I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared in my 50s, for example, for this rush of creative energy that kind of came up and all kinds of ideas were present day and night. And I thought, wow, what is this? You know, I can't act on them all. There's just so much. And I think that our journey, into the later years hasn't been mapped. Nobody's really chronicled it. Nobody's ever really talked about what we can expect or what kinds of things have happened, what kinds of miracles have happened to people who are in the 70th decade, in the 80th decade, in the 90th decade. What is that experience? What is that view? What do all the boundaries come down, or is there this penetrating refinement? I don't know. I'm very curious about that.
And so am I.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, my mind is just, you're leading my mind into unknown territory. So that's my silence, and it's a good one. Yeah. Great.
But I don't think that there is such a thing as old age. There may be wisdom, there may be no wisdom. I'm not quite sure what the path is, but I don't think it's anything that's ever been well described.
Right. Well, because, you know, this particular generation, if we can call the baby boomer generation for want of a better label, a new place, we're really pioneers of a whole nother way of growing older, of being older than 50.
Yeah.
Totally different than our parents. And totally different than the younger generation. Like, I can't imagine what they're going to be like. It's just like, and it's way beyond what I've known. They're way beyond what I've known now. So I can't imagine what's going to happen in 30 more years.
Yeah, the open-mindedness is really, it's pretty amazing.
It is wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So
I'm, you know, back So that's kind of my task is now I'm looking at people who come to see me or whom I meet and who are older than me. And I'm trying to understand what it's like to be at the 70th or the 80th decade and what the challenges are of that decade and what are the transcendental qualities of that decade. And to try to map and at least leave some kind of chronicle or some kind of mention for people who come upon it. It may be different for them too. They may have an even more expanded awareness of this potential.
Right. But I think that's a great project.
Yeah.
Because, it's well known, though nobody has ever really written it down, that the people that my grandmother initiated who, reached the age of elderliness, like 80s and 90s, some of them are still in Hawaii and connectable, I would say. But 10 or 15 years ago, there was a whole population of these people. And some Reiki people who were much more into research and so on than I was went there and interviewed these people. And they are the ones who are walking around nursing homes or retirement homes or old people's homes in those days and giving other people Reiki. They're still eating. They're still cognizant of where they are. They're the leaders of the community, really.
Wow.
Yeah. So that would be, that's a fantastic, place for somebody to go to if anybody's looking for a research project.
Well, and is that also not the potential of the Reiki home? Is that some of these topics are worthy of exploration and inclusion in any dimension of Reiki in reaching into these spaces that haven't been explored before. Right. Maybe you should call it the Reiki spaceship.
Well, that's exactly what it feels like to me, actually. The Reiki spaceship, I have to say. So, yes, I feel like this is we're starting to catch glimpses of where we are going with this.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Kathy, we're just about out of time. So
amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. And what a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
I've so enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great. Me too. And we'll have more conversations to come, which is even more exciting.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.